The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Beauvais.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Beauvais.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is your station for talk and business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. Nathan and I will be here doing our history class, as usual, on Wednesdays. But if you'd like to interrupt us, we would like you to interrupt us with a question you might have about your personal financial life. A podcast available at 790business.com. Markets down slightly across the board today. It's been a heck of a run. S&P up about 10% year-to-date. I would expect some sort of a reprieve along the way. That's pretty good performance. Not expected by most. We'll see where the year ends up. Long-term stock returns by most super economists, that means people with more experience than myself, talk about expecting stock returns over time, U.S. companies, to be more like 7 on the softer side going forward. And that's natural when a country grows up and becomes a mature economy versus being an emerging market. We're talking about emerging markets a lot in the program the last year or two. This isn't going to last that long. Historically, they have these runs, and once it's been 2 good years, they start to scare me. So if you don't have any emerging markets exposure, I think you need to get a piece of that at least for another year or two. We're talking about dividends in the oil industry tonight. Nathan's going to be talking about history of that industry in general. Of course, oil and energy, of course, are not only a huge part of our economy. They had one of the
one that's out of favor.
It's out of favor, which you always love to have that. You know, the energy industry isn't going to stay out of favor forever. You know, any one company might. In Peter Lynch's book, One Up on Wall Street, he said that buggy whips and TV tubes were the two industries that somebody thought would recover. And what he meant was, it doesn't always, which is why, as you know, Nathan, I always prefer to buy an industry if I have an itch to scratch in the investment world versus a company.
Sure, a company can go out of business, and an industry can, but it's rare. Yeah. It doesn't happen overnight, usually,
exactly.
Industry going out of business,
right.
But
right.
It does happen from
and
time
no
to time.
And no one individual can run an industry aground, but it can run a company aground in one person.
Right, right. But like a consumer discretionary company, the industry and as a whole is not going to disappear over the next couple of years.
Not likely, not likely.
Whereas the company Sears is most likely going to not be around in a couple of years, I would take a guess.
It's looking like that, isn't it, huh?
It is, yeah.
The changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
These things do change. I think I read an interesting article for those of you that might own Harley Davidson stock. I mean, they'll probably morph into something else that people do want. But I don't think this generation of young people are motorcycle buyers anywhere near the generations of the past.
I don't think so either.
Demand seems to be really down for motorcycles.
Yeah, especially Harley Davidson. I would think those old school style.
If anything, maybe more the foreign bikes, Hondas and things like that might be more in vogue,
Right.
But I just don't think that many people are into the outdoors as they used to be. I think it's a kind of a trend of society moving that way. I've read a lot about that in demographics and things, There's less and less people hunting and fishing, I think, than generations ago at age 15 and 16.
That's true.
Seems to be the trend. I notice it when I visit the Adirondack Mountains up there. They have a real youth problem up there.
Oh, yeah. People fleeing.
Oh, they want opportunity. You can't blame them at all. You know, if it was you, I lived up there, in a hut, I'd miss you, but I've been encouraging you to get the heck out of there and where there's a better opportunity, unless you want to be a park ranger. What a beautiful life.
Right.
Great.
I used to be a music teacher when I was younger, and, I had a lot of young kids who really were ambitious and wanted to play music and make a career out of it. And I always said to them, well, if you really want to do that, you should probably go to where there is a marketplace for it that's better than around here. There really isn't that great of a market for it around here. But luckily, it's not that far away. New York City is not that far away. It's only a three-hour drive, and it's a great market for that. So if you really want to do that. That being said, there's a lot more people, a lot more players in the market.
Competition.
There's a lot more competition. But you know, I have some really good friends who just moved to Tennessee to pursue their dreams in music, and they tell me it's night and day.
Sure.
Night and
sure,
day.
Sure. Swimming in a different soup.
Yeah, yeah.
Completely.
Yeah, just a much bigger appetite for that service, that product.
And probably more respect for it, but more compensation for the same thing.
Yep.
Everything, because there's no higher demand.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, if you want
to. And that works for every industry, every job that you're trying to look into.
You go where the items are that you're looking for.
Right.
I would think, right?
Right, right. What did Jim Rohn, our favorite Jim Rohn, said? He said, bring the seed, the soil, your seed, not your need.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes,
so sometimes you got to find that soil.
Reaping is designed for the sowers.
So, like Don Sowa?
So is, yeah. I thought that was kind of cute and coincidental. So is meaning sowing of the seeds. But the phrase is the reaping is reserved for the sowers, which means you don't plant, you don't reap. You know,
that's right.
It's an old-fashioned conservative viewpoint of people like me who think you should work for what you get. and so that was always a funny coincidence, actually, the sowers.
That's right.
Which, of course, that's our fearless leader is that name, those of you who don't know. Anyway, the energy sector is a big part of our economy. I don't believe it'll stay down. Stocks, dividends are real fascinating, and we've talked about it quite a bit, and I'll sneak in just a moment here of education. For example, Nathan, what are some of these dividends right now, rates on some of these oil companies?
Well, I put together a list of the five of the largest oil companies in the world today, and on that list are very familiar names everyone's heard before. BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil, PetroChina, and Royal Dutch Shell. And all but one of these companies is paying a dividend over 3.5%.
Nice.
But what's interesting about dividends is that they are responsive to the price of the stock itself, right? So if it's paying, they pay a fixed dollar per share. If the price goes up, the dividend goes down.
Well, right. if a new purchase was
right,
made,
for new purchases, right? But the current, when you look up the current yield, what is it yielding today?
Right.
If the price goes up and they haven't increased the number of
change the dividend payout,
they haven't changed the payout, right? Right. Then it goes down.
The percentage goes down, right?
Right. Right. But dividend paying stocks. This is funny. You mentioned Peter Lynch a minute ago in his book One Up on Wall Street. One of my favorite parts in that book that I found interesting was that stocks that pay a high dividend have a bit of a cushion in them, because when the prices drop, the dividend shoots up and makes it attractive, almost puts like a floor on the price.
And you have a dividend to reinvest when the price is low without using new capital.
Think of a all growth company that doesn't pay any dividend.
Right.
When this price goes down, there's nothing really there.
It's like raw land.
There's nothing. Yeah, right. Exactly. It's raw land. Whereas,
you got to sell it for more later. That's the only way you're going to make
any
money.
Great example. If you got a rental property on a piece of land, the land goes down, you're still collecting the rents. You're making something. You know, at least
young
you're making
people,
some money.
Young people are more comfortable with, and it's more appropriate for younger people to have investments for their retirement account that are like raw land. Example: if you have a growth stock in your IRA at your age that pays very little dividend, that's very appropriate for you. I don't think it is for me at almost age 60. I want 3% dividend on everything I own at my age. Everything I own, my investments, has a 3% or higher dividend, or I don't have it.
Right.
That's my rule.
So if you're shooting for a total return of 6, you got half of it.
Half it's accomplished through the dividend, right?
You don't even need the growth.
Right. And if you have stagnated economies for stagnation, things for a length of time, at least you got the 3% kick out, the rentals, you know?
Right.
Now, right now, the oil sector, energy sector is out of favor. So to me, you're buying on sale, or one of the most important dynamic industries in the greatest economy in the world, and you get a dividend while you're waiting for the share price to rebound.
Doesn't sound like a bad deal.
I like it a lot. I like
it
a lot. Now, these are individual stocks Nathan's talking about. We are always going to recommend that those of you who are interested in something like this, that you first try to buy an ETF. This is at least my own thoughts. Nathan's younger. He's a little more comfortable, I think, with the individual stocks. But my experience tells me that for most people, they're better off owning the industry, because you could buy one of these great companies, you know, and then something insane happens where they have an explosion somewhere and they're found to be at fault of hiding safety violations, and that stock could go to zero in a couple of months.
Yeah.
In a situation like that where the industry really can't.
What's the one that I just recently?
It's not likely, I agree, but it can, you know.
What's the burrito company? Chipotle.
Yes.
Right? They're a hot new company.
Yep. Yep.
Right, people were getting in on that, and all of a sudden news came out that they had some bad meat or something, and all of a sudden that price tanked, you know. So
yes.
it probably wouldn't have been a better idea. I mean, depending on which situation you're in, but you could get maybe an ETF that invested in on those types of companies. You
or, know, something similar, like as we say. Yeah.
Or just be very well diversified. You know?
There's an energy ETF that we like, IGE. That's pays about a dividend, about I think it's about 3%, 2.5 to 3%, and it's a diversified natural resources, so it's got a bunch of different stuff in it. But it's been a bit of a hindrance the last few years. Clients have complained about it. I try not to remove it because, again, keep in mind, most of my clients are in my stage of life, at least, you know, and so we're more conservative with our principal than somebody younger might be. So that always matters. That's why we think having Nathan here with me, and on Tuesday night Donna is with her father, to have that different age group on the show, or the influence on the show, I think is important, because as I get older, I'm naturally less comfortable with risk myself, my own nature, my personality. And so am I the right person to advise a 26-year-old how to really be a risky, long-term, aggressive growth investor? I don't think I am.
Right.
I'm not the right cat for that, you know? Somebody younger, actually in our office, we're all so conservative, and that's just fine with us. You know, that's always been our reputation. So I don't know if there's anybody in our office that would be suitable to that sort of high-flying activity. That really is your old-fashioned brokerage broker, or today, Nathan, what most people would want to do, that would probably do it themselves.
I would think so, an E-Trade or something like that.
Yeah,
you really know,
low cost, right, probably.
Right. But then again, I mean, if you're talking large sums of money, man, that's a frightening thing to me. Well, to be doing all that with individual stocks and stuff like that. So I would think you'd want to get some professional advice.
I would think so. You know? Do you remember me telling you one of my favorite stories about the night a fellow called the show and said, "I've been listening to you for a long time, Steve, and I love your show, and I think you're a great advisor. I know you're a big man, so you won't be bothered by what I'm about to say." And he said this live. And I let him go. I didn't try to cut him off. You know, I had faith. I felt okay for some reason. You know, and he said to me, "Today in this world, we can get all the information online, Vanguard, commission-free trades, all the research is there. You know, don't take it the wrong way, pal. You know, I really like you." He goes, "But what do I need you for?" and I said, I took a deep breath, and I said, "What's my heart tell me to say?" And I said, "I live in Smithfield. I have a garage, and I have every tool necessary to build a house, and I still can't do it." He said, "Excellent answer." Meaning some people have the skills to invest on their own, but just because it's been made inexpensive, it doesn't mean that you can do it. That doesn't mean you have the knowledge or talent to do it just because it's inexpensive. So I'm a pretty handy guy myself with all kinds of skills with my hands, mechanics, pottery, but I cannot put a piece of board up straight or do finish work of any kind whatsoever. So we all have our skills. If you have the skills yourself, you can call shows like ours for no charge at all and get some input for your journey. This is the Money Talk Show with Nathan and Steve Beauvais, and we'll both be right back.
Liquidators today.
This is Money Talk with Steve Beauvais, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talk and business. 437-5000 for another few minutes, a half hour, if you have a question or a concern. We'd be happy to chat with you about it. You can actually drop us an assignment if you like. Some things, if done correctly, take time, and we wouldn't want to wing it. If you have an issue like that, we'll find the answer for you and report to you what night we can get back to you. It might be another team member that delivers it. We've done that many times in the past. Don, you know, in the office, flipped something on my desk and said, "Hey, a caller called," and I told him to tune in next Thursday. He said he couldn't tune in that night, so can you cover this for him and make sure you get this to him by Wednesday? You know, that kind of answer. So we can do those kind of things as well. Wednesday night is history night, and we're talking about the oil or the natural resources industry because it's out of favor right now. So I think there's opportunity for purchase. Doesn't mean that's exactly the bottom, and really nice dividends as well. But how did the oil industry in America begin, Nathan?
Began in earnest, as they say, in the 1850s, which ironically was happening at a time in our country's history where we were really an emerging market.
Yes, we were.
And expanding incredibly. Yes. Railroads were being built everywhere.
Yep.
California Gold Rush had just happened one decade before this. So there was lots of an injection of currency and money into the system. It was like throwing a match into a barrel of oil, no pun intended. But it began actually in Pennsylvania. Most people would guess Texas.
I did. You quizzed me on that one. I got that wrong. I said Texas, not Pennsylvania.
Northwestern Pennsylvania, 1859 in August. We're coming up on the anniversary, actually. August 27th of 1859 was when the first well was first drilled in western Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Now, oil had been used for other you know, things before. It was called rock oil. It was a byproduct of coal production. There were some companies that actually, you know, dug these raw materials out of the ground, and it was. But they took this idea from salt drilling. They actually used to drill for salt, and they wanted to apply the same technique. We'll just drill for oil instead. And people laughed at them. Oh, you're crazy! That'll never work. And you've heard tell me if you've heard that story before, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Eventually,
that's what we were told when we tried to do this radio show. No one's ever done it before. You're crazy.
Nonsense.
It won't work. Right. And Don said, "I love when I hear that stuff."
Right.
When everyone tells me I'm wrong, I kind of get a drive from that, you know?
So the big thing that was driving this search for oil and was that the idea that it could be used as an illuminant. Up until this point, it was really turpentine.
Illuminant?
Illuminant.
Good word usage, son.
Yes, right. A word that, you know, stuff that's used to
well
illuminate.
Placed. Yeah, well placed. Yes.
But anyway, whale oil was another one that was used. But a lot of the whales are going extinct. They were just killing them all for whale oil and light stuff up. But... So it became very expensive. They were looking for a substitute. And this company here was called the Pennsylvania Rock Oil Company. They drilled for oil. They got the oil out of the ground, and they obtained this report from this guy from Yale who was this big professor who had a lot of credential, and he verified the substance and was able to generate a lot of capital inflow and investments because people thought, oh, this is gonna work, right? And it did.
Well, the future of machinery, you know,
right,
is what really drove it, I would think.
Really, it was illumination, but that was part of it. You're right.
Because of kerosene initially?
Yeah.
But in the long run of energy, it's really machinery.
Yeah, a combustible engine.
Yeah, combustible engine.
Right, machinery. Which wouldn't happen until, you know, the early 1900s. But before the turn of the century, it was really just kerosene was what the big driving product was from oil production.
And that's what took over from the whale oil, correct?
Yes, right. It was this town called Titusville, which at the time of the discovery was only about 125 people. And the oil was just being pumped out of the ground at the time. But when it was finally drilled for successfully, like I was talking about, the population doubled overnight. Land prices shot up. People made tons of money in real estate.
Of course.
Tons of money in real estate. These guys who started this company became instantly, you know, wealthy. But 15 months after the first discovery, there were 75 wells producing oil in that area. And the supply would soon outrun the demand. The wooden barrels that they used to store the oil cost more than a barrel of oil. The barrel itself costs more. So the companies that were making ancillary products were really making out.
Just like the Gold Rush.
Just like the Gold Rush, right? With what's the guy's name? Levi, right? Levi's jeans, right?
Those that provide fellow human beings what they want, that's what success is.
Right. Samuel Brennan was another guy who made a ton of money in the Gold Rush, and he sold just pickaxes. He had one of the first general stores on the ground that sold basic needs to the miners,
yes.
And he made way more money than anybody digging
except
gold.
Except maybe three of the gold miners.
Yeah, except like some guys who
hit
the jackpot.
Of them,
right.
But the majority, not even close.
Yeah.
I agree.
But just to kind of give you an idea of how much of a supply glut there was here, in 1860, they were producing 450,000 barrels that year out of this oil regions area of Pennsylvania. 2 years later, 3 million barrels. In January of 1861, it was a barrel of oil went for $10. And in June of that same year, it dropped to 50 cents. And by December, it was going for 10 cents a barrel.
Wow.
So that you can't make a profit. You know,
no,
all these
can't.
People are flooding into this area trying to get rich quick, which is what happened in the California Gold Rush. Same thing. People
same
trying to get rich quick.
Same thing, yep.
Speculation, some people would call it. I would think
sure.
It would
be. All reason goes aside.
Right.
People
right,
in that
right,
mode.
Right. But something happened, actually.
What kind of violence do you think was occurring in those towns when people
were
gold mining and all that? Are you kidding me?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. In fact, I'm glad you said that, actually.
You better be the biggest guy in the camp or be quiet, because there's no cop to save you.
There's a great book out there called...
I Can Run Really Fast.
The Prize by Daniel Yergin. It's a heavy read, but it's really good. It won a Pulitzer Prize back in the early 90s, and it's a history of the oil industry. It's a great, great book. But there's a quote in the book from one of the local newspapers in Titusville, when this whole mania was going on and people were first discovering oil. It says, quote, "The oil and land excitement in this section has already become a sort of epidemic. It embraces all classes and ages and conditions of men. They neither talk nor look nor act as they did 6 months ago. Land, leases, contracts, refusals, deeds, agreements, interest, and all sorts of talk is all they can comprehend. Strange faces meet us at every turn, and half of our inhabitants can be more readily found in New York or Philadelphia than at home. The court is at a standstill. The bar is demoralized. The social circle is broken. The sanctuary is forsaken. And all our habits and notions and associations for half a century are turned topsy-turvy in the headlong rush for riches. Some poor men become rich. Some rich men become richer. Some poor men and some rich men lose all they invest. And so we go. And the editor had one final thought. He said, this big bubble will burst sooner or later.
And well said.
And it did.
Oh yes.
Oh,
it did.
It did.
Yes, it did.
The famous story of the bubble bursting was this town called Pithole, Pennsylvania. A great name.
Pithole.
So when we come back from a break, we're up against it right now. Is that right?
Yeah.
We'll come back. We'll talk about Pithole, Pennsylvania. A fantastic story in financial history.
We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Bum, 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 bum. Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business.
His hair was perfect.
The werewolves tonight are Nathan and Stephen Bove. Yes, father and son, financial advisors. Tuesday night, normally, Don and his daughter, Donna Grace, both financial advisors also. We just think that it's wonderful to have our children involved in this endeavor of ours here, and we do think the youth injection has been phenomenal. I love it in the office. They have fast brains.
It's kind of ironic that I'm the youth. You bring me on to talk about maybe some youthful things, and I talk about stuff that happened 100 years ago.
You're the historian, and you're the guy without the gray.
Ironic.
Yeah, it is. But you're good at it. You always loved history. I know that.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So please, tell me about, we're talking about the beginning of the oil industry, because that's
right.
Kind of our theme. It's out of favor, good to look at for buying opportunities right now, we think. It must have been very Wild West-ish in the beginning when it started. Volatile, I would think.
Yes, yeah. And right before the break, we were talking about that newspaper article, which talked about the bubble eventually going to be bursting. And it did in 1865. So it was about 7 years after oil was first discovered in the region, in the famous case of Pithole, Pennsylvania, which was about 15 miles from Titusville. I know, great name, right?
If you live in Pithole, do you admit it? Do you tell anybody that? The poor folks that live there.
Yeah, right.
Probably the nicest people in the world. Listen to me.
Anyway,
terrible, Stephen.
It was only 15 miles from the epicenter where they first discovered oil, but there was virtually no population at all. There was a little population in Titusville, very small. But in Pithole, there was basically nothing there. It's the guy and his dog probably sitting out on his porch. But by June, the oil was discovered in January, and in June, there were four flowing wells producing 2,000 barrels per day, and that was a third of the region's output, one-third of this new deposit that they found in Pennsylvania. But within a few months of discovery, 15,000 people had moved to this area. There were banks and churches and railroads. A water system was put in. One farm, which was virtually worthless before the oil was discovered, sold for $1.3 million in July, and then $2 million in September. And that's in 1850s dollars. I'm not talking inflated. That's back then. By 1866, all the oil had dried up. Only a year later, it was total ghost town. And you can Google Pithole, Pennsylvania, and there's lots of pictures of rigs in the woods and stuff
right,
like
I'm
that.
Sure. Yeah.
That farmland that I talked about that sold for $2 million in September of 1865 sold for $4.37 in 1878.
Wow.
Yeah. So all this information that I have comes from Daniel Yergin's book, The Prize.
Why or how can the price of something swing that wildly? And the answer, folks, is because in a free market system, value is an opinion.
Oh, of course. You always ask me,
no price.
What's your car worth? Just whatever someone's
whatever the next person's willing
to
do, sell it for, right?
Right, right, right.
Exactly right.
There were some other weird things.
Nobody wants to buy your house. You want to sell it. What's your house worth? Nothing.
Right, yeah.
Right.
That's right.
It's got to be a buyer.
Like a penny stock. That's another
That's why they're tough, because you can't get rid of them.
You can't always get rid of them, right?
Oh, I bought it at 8 cents. It's worth $8 billion, and you watch it fall back to 8 cents because nobody will buy it from you. You pull your hair out. People don't realize that can happen. They think you put a trade in, it'll sell instantly.
Oh, yeah, it'll sell.
No, it doesn't work that way.
No, not with small trade. It sucks. Or thinly, I should say, is the
yes.
proper way. But there was this weird thing going on in this time period. It was called Rule of Capture. Obviously, there were no laws put on the books yet for regulating this industry. There weren't really any books to regulate anything back then.
Back then, right.
But imagine a milkshake, right? The oil deposit is a milkshake, and you've got your straw, and you're sucking the oil, the milkshake out, and you're I'm getting a lot of oil here, you know? And then someone comes along and puts in a bigger straw and can suck it out way faster, right? And they pull it all out in a week and got way more than you got out working
six months. Right.
And they set up their derrick, was called an oil derrick, 50 yards from yours and just drained the well, you know.
Because they get a little better technology.
Right, yeah. I mean, it didn't matter. You couldn't claim a well. You couldn't say that because I occupy this area.
Right.
No one knew where the oil was. I mean, you couldn't see it. It was underground.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
right.
it was very this
unlike a mine, you can visually see the ore in the side of the rock. So you can say, that's my mine. I got a claim on it. You can't go in there.
Yeah, that was known as Rule of Capture.
Rule of Capture.
Back then. But the depression hit the industry in the 1860s, right around this time that I'm talking about. The price of oil kind of was about $2.40 a barrel back then. But it cost more to move the oil a few miles to the train station than to New York City from the oil regions. It became a huge issue, transporting the oil.
Yeah, big, sloppy, slippery,
sloppy
heavy,
stuff,
heavy. How heavy is oil?
Yeah, right. An
oil tank full of oil must weigh a ton.
But by 1866, most wells were using wooden pipelines, believe it or not. Pipelines were set up even back then. But they, of course, broke down and had to be tended to, and a lot of sabotage going on from competitors.
Sabotage.
Yeah, yep. Of course, we'll talk about that later
on. That's part of the Wild West.
With Sanders, John Rockefeller and Standard Oil, of course, were the leaders in that category.
Shenanigans.
I said Pennsylvania was the original state that oil was discovered,
yes.
But most people would guess it was...
Was it discovered by mistake, do you know?
No. They were searching for it.
They understood it was searching for it.
Oh, yeah, the guys who founded the company...
I thought maybe somebody drilled a hole to put a pole in the ground and
up came
Jed Clampett.
No.
The bubbling crude.
No, well, that has happened in history, but...
I'm sure it has. Yeah.
In this situation, no, actually, what happened was in that northwestern area in Pennsylvania, there had been known natural springs to bubble up, and oil came out.
Okay.
And they used oil for certain things. Actually, it was used as a...
Well, oil floats on top of water, right?
A cure-all. Yes, right, it does.
So if you get mixed with it, it'll come to the top.
It was used as a cure-all, believe it or not, for medicine.
Really?
I've heard of snake oil salesman.
Mm.
That's what that was. People going door to door selling the oil coming from the ground as a medicine to cure anything and everything. But Texas didn't come on the scene until about 1900. Oil was discovered in Texas in 1866 at a place called Melrose in East Texas. But it wouldn't be until 1900, right around 1901, that spindle top, which was the big gusher, when you think of the gusher going up to the sky, 50 feet in the air, that was 1901. And it wasn't far from the original spot they found oil. But there were 836 barrels of oil produced in Texas in 1900. The next year, 1901, 4.3 million barrels produced. So that, again... The supply outruns demand.
What
and
a
the
dangerous job
drop.
That was, I'll bet.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of fires.
Oh, yeah. And in Pennsylvania, there was a story of one of the wells burning for 3 days straight. A huge explosion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very, very, very dangerous. In 1900, prices had dropped to 3 cents a barrel.
Union situation. That kind of danger in the job. You need a union to protect those workers.
That's like, all those dangerous jobs. Coal mining.
Anything like that. Sure.
Whether there was any of that stuff. But the book that I referenced earlier, the Prize, it's called, by Daniel Yergin. The subtitle is The Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993, I think. Goes on. The first chapter talks about kind of what I'm talking about right now, how the birth started in America. But then it goes into the next chapter, which really talks about John Rockefeller and Standard Oil, which is a really fascinating story about business and integration. Standard Oil was the first integrated company. So what does that mean? What do I mean by integration? Well, there's two ways you can be integrated as a company. You can be vertically integrated or you can be horizontally integrated. You can be both vertically and horizontally. The best way to think about vertical integration is, say you own Well, think about the oil company, for example, right? There were four industries in oil. There was production, taking it out of the ground.
Yep.
Refining, which is taking oil and producing products like kerosene or gasoline. Then there was transporting the oil to the marketplace. And then there was advertising.
Marketing. Yeah.
Right. And that applied to lots of different industries. But there weren't any companies that thought, for whatever reason, why don't we own the company that does the marketing, too? Why don't we own the company that does the transporting, too?
Right.
Standard Oil was the first company to ever be vertically integrated like that on a massive scale.
Right.
You know, they first were in refining only. That's how they started. Then they transporting the oil, and then marketing. They got into production last, and we'll talk about that maybe in the next segment. But, of course, Rockefeller was born in 1839 in New York. He lived to 97 years old, believe that.
Wow.
Yeah. That's old back then. That's really old.
He had the best health care.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
Goes with some bucks.
I'm sure. Yeah,
always did. Always will.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, hopefully not. I think today we're getting close to everyone having very, very good health care, kind of even, I hope.
Yeah,
we'll get closer to it anyway than we were back then. That's for sure, right?
Yeah. He actually was.
But I think no matter what we put in place in any one nation, there's always might be another nation. If you have the dough, you can get on a plane and fly there and maybe get a little better thing. You never know, right?
Yeah,
a lot of wealthy people do that. They leave the country for certain illnesses where there's a specialty.
Clearly, we could digress on that topic
for
hours.
Natural, sure. Yeah.
Rockefeller got involved in produce. He was really into fruits, apparently. Yeah, he owned a company that was just sold produce, and then he got into the oil.
Another staple that everyone wants and
needs. Yeah, but in the 1860s, the craze hit, the oil, and he got into it, and he found out that he was good at it, but he probably would have been good. He probably would have been a produce magnate, if he'd stayed in
whatever
produce.
Whatever
he did, probably,
Usually that's the case.
Yeah. But he really wanted to push the company that he had partnered with his buddy there, and Maurice Clark was his partner's name. And he had to buy his partner out because his partner was not interested in going all in oil refining. And he credits that day as the biggest decision he ever made in his life was buying out his partner and going all in oil refining. And that was in 1865.
Crossroads, huh? Decisions.
That was 1865. And when you think about it, that was that was not a good time. I just talked about 1866, a Great Depression in the industry. Depression hit the industry 1866 to 1867. When did John Rockefeller get all in? Right then.
When there's blood in the streets.
Exactly, right. That's that's the
same
key.
Lesson every time, right?
What were we just talking about in the first segment, right?
Right.
Energy sector is out of favor.
Sure.
That's the time to...
One of my favorite little lessons I would do years ago with clients I was teaching about investments, if it was a long-term, kind of equity investment that was out of favor and they wanted to sell it low, I would take out my checkbook and tell them I was going to buy it personally from them because it's such a good opportunity. And they'd stop looking at me and go, all right, never mind, leave it alone.
All right, I'll sell it.
All right, I'll keep it. All right, I guess you're pretty serious about this there, young man. And it usually worked pretty well to get the point across.
Right.
This is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
I always wanted, some reason I feel like I have to wait till after that little before we reopen the show here on AM 790, your station for talk and business. I am a rather experienced certified financial planner professional, 38 years experience in the financial business, 25 years behind the microphone. We have the young man here as well with lots of experience now, 3 years. Moving on.
I've been alive 33 years.
Yeah. Thanks. That's a nice compliment. Appreciate that, son. And he's here to be our historian, as you well know now, usually on Wednesdays. We can move the show around a bit, too. But Wednesdays, we talk about history. We're talking about the oil industry in general, a little bit about how it started, what it was like. And we talked about stocks. And now we're going to talk a little bit about some ETFs.
I've got a list of the largest ETFs and mutual funds. So depending on how your philosophy is, if you like the passive stuff, I got some stuff, some information on that and some active stuff. So let's look at the passive stuff first, the ETFs. Three of the largest ETFs, and when I say largest, I mean has the highest assets under management. So these are the most money invested in
and
these.
That would matter because ETFs can decide to close if they don't raise enough capital, or if they blow a certain level, they can't run out of profit.
Right.
Then they close out and send you your money back if the share price is low. Too bad you lose.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of that over the years because there's a craze, I think, with ETFs.
There was a craze, and if you can't raise enough capital, you might buy it at $40 a share and they close it at $10.
Some people get these crackpot ideas, you know, careful. Like, hey, let's open an ETF that invests only in G.I. Joe's.
Ice cream shops or something.
Yeah, right.
So that's exactly. Those are the ones that end up closing because they can't raise enough capital to run at a profit. Economies of scale. They have to be a certain size to even be able to run.
Yep.
And you got to be real careful with that with ETFs.
So the three largest ETFs right now that you can invest in that are centered in the energy sector are the Energy Select Sector SPDR, the SPDR ETF. The symbol is XLE. Current yield on that one is 2.5%, and it's pretty out of favor.
Oh, yeah.
Year-to-date, 6-month, 12-month, 3-year, all down. The other one...
Started the year at $76 a share. It's $64 now.
iShares U.S. Energy ETF. I know you've had some experience with this one, Dad. IYE is the symbol on that one. Yield, the current yield on that is 2.3. Vanguard Energy ETF. I think that's the largest one in the country right now for energy ETFs. That's VDE is the symbol on that one. It's got a yield of 2.6.
All have the exact same chop pattern.
Yeah.
Down.
Yeah,
you know,
it's what you guys see.
Share price is down 20-25% and just this year. But let's take a look at what VDE was, the Vanguard, right? Let's go back 5 years and take a look at the share price of this fund. It's lower than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
With a 3% dividend. When you see something that's a core economy and the share price, right, you can buy this fund cheaper per share than you could 5 years ago. That's a good value. Doesn't mean it's the cheapest it's ever going to be, but I think it's close.
The only thing that's really, I see that it's a difference is the expense ratios on these. Of course, they're passive, so they're very, very low. The iShares one, the IVE, IYE is the symbol. The expense ratio is almost half, 0.5, where the other ones are like 0.14, 0.1.
So a difference of 0.7, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
And what's the dividend? Does it show up in the dividend?
The dividend's lower on the one with the higher expense ratio.
Right. Yeah. Makes sense. It would be.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Right. Right.
Then if you're into the active game, you know, mutual funds that are actively managed, the three largest mutual funds in the country that are investing in the energy sector are the Fidelity Select Energy, which
it's gotta be a whopper.
Symbol is FSENX. Invesco Energy is another one. Symbol is IENBX, and then the Vanguard Energy Mutual Fund, VGENX. The Vanguard's got a good yield, too, but the other two have very, very low yields, right around 50 basis points for those less than 1%. The Vanguard one, when you look at it compared to other funds in its category, has really performed well. It's got it's a 5-year rank. It's in the fifth percentile, top 5% in the category. 3-year rank, top 10% in its category. The other ones, like Invesco's, kind of lagging in there. You know, bottom 70% for the 5 and 3 year. Expense ratio is pretty high on that Invesco one too. You know, that
doesn't help.
The Invesco, doesn't help.
The more you believe in passive investing, the more expenses become a factor because you can control them.
Yeah.
If you're going to just ride the index for the return, then expenses are everything.
Yeah, right.
It's the only thing you can control.
But they're very. I mean, we're talking. I'm talking. These three are three mutual funds. They're. I believe they're actively managed. But this is a pretty low expense ratio for a mutual fund. 0.78. You know, 0.4. That's really low for a mutual fund.
It is
0.4.
It is
the Vanguard Energy.
And sometimes today these are established funds, but sometimes today you'll see funds come out that are relatively new with a teaser expense ratio to attract money sometimes. And even some of the main companies will subsidize. I've seen reports like from Vanguard, for example, and it says expense ratio over here, but it says below subsidized by 0.5. Companies trying to get their little buddy going.
Yeah, I get you.
To attract more dollars if it's a little cheaper.
Yeah, as far as those mutual funds go, I mean, that Invesco one doesn't look very appetizing. It's really down as far as the rank.
One could have global exposure, one not at all. That could be the reason of performance. And that's about to invert any minute. So the one that didn't perform well, what you're looking at, could be the best one to go.
Yeah.
Going, you never know.
But the expense ratio is so much
higher
than the other two.
And today we avoid that usually because we can control it. It's something we can control. So people in our business who audit us, they very expect very much today evidence that you've done all you can to keep the expenses as low as possible in your client accounts.
the beta is
because it's
something
you can't control, is it?
Yeah, that on that Invesco one, high expense ratio, higher beta than all the other ones.
Might be a different capitalization, small cap versus large, you know, globalization versus not, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, but that's an interesting point. I mean, I would assume they'd be these similar because they're all like the three largest funds in that sector. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, you never know. Yeah, I remember one time a client called up and asked about one particular fund, and it was listed as the best performing growth fund. And I looked it up, and I had to type in the symbol six times. It was all Korean, or South Korean. This is 20 years ago, son, a long time ago.
Wow.
But it was one country. But it was just listed as a growth fund.
That's
because
weird.
The word growth fund doesn't specify country, right?
No,
or anything.
No,
just
no,
a growth
no,
fund.
No.
But it was all one nation, and it had performed very, very well. And when I looked into it, I said to the client, I wouldn't buy into this one nation now at the top of the cycle. And, of course, it was minus 74% the following year. Had that been fully diversified pattern of behavior, then it would have been a little safer buy-in. But when it's one country, one item like that, and it's got great performance before you bought it, don't buy it, usually, right? Usually.
Right.
That's how it works. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. Nathan and I are Wednesday night talking about history. If you have a history topic you'd like us to develop and present for you on a following Wednesday, we'd be happy to do that if you drop us a little clue about what you might be interested in. Again, I do think this sector right now, that's why we chose it for tonight. Not only is it a good history lesson or topic, but it's also one of the most important sectors for people that are older that have a good chunk of money, that are thinking a lot about preserving their money and being careful with their principal. The two things that human beings cannot be without is food and energy. And so these are considered to be some of the staple defensive protection issues for older people to have. And you know what? It's held returns down the past several years. But that, to me, tells me when you see those categories underperform like that, I think we got a broader market correction showing up around the corner, not too far away from now. We don't try to market time, but we do try to be sensitive to clients' needs and the current environment that we're in. This is the Money Talk Show. Tune in tomorrow night for more Money Talk right here on AM 790, your station for talk and business. Working for the public.